Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer, and I'm the director of Northwestern University's Infrastructure Technology Institute.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Herman of Vocalo.org, 89.5 FM.
The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. Two major earthquakes happening within a month of each other in early 2010 galvanized the world's attention. Highly publicized was the role that building codes played in the differing losses of life in the two events.
Chile, which has rigorous earthquake building codes, suffered approximately 520 fatalities from the magnitude 8.8 earthquake of February 27, while the number of fatalities in Haiti, whose building codes are lax, were estimated at 230,000 from the magnitude 7 earthquake that struck there on January 12th.
What are the implications of a megaquake for buildings and other structures in the United States? Some people looking for the next big one in this country are predicting the San Andreas Fault in California, others the Cascadia Fault near the Pacific Northwest, or the New Madrid Fault in the Midwest. Are we prepared? To discuss this important topic with us today, we have with us an expert on earthquake engineering design, Dr. Sharon Wood, who's a professor of civil engineering and chair of the Department of Civil, Architectural, and Environmental Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. Sharon, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Joe.
Can you tell us a little bit about what makes a structure particularly vulnerable to earthquake damage?
Sure. To answer this, let's talk about the loads that act on a building. A building has to be designed for both gravity loads, which are like the self-weight and the live load. Those loads are always present. And then during an earthquake, lateral loads are induced because the ground is moving. So there are some buildings that are constructed by experience. They aren't really designed. And these buildings have the strength to resist the gravity loads, but not lateral loads. So when the earthquake comes, these buildings collapse. And you can think about a child's building blocks. You can stack those up. It'll carry gravity load. A child can actually stand on the blocks. But if you were to put lateral load on it, the little structure would collapse. So I think that's the type of thing that we see in construction that's not engineered. And that might be unreinforced masonry or adobe construction. An additional consequence is that these materials are very heavy. So when the buildings do collapse, the weight of the materials coming down will often kill the people and the inhabitants.
Are all earthquakes the same in the way that they shake structures?
There are many similarities. What happens is that the ground will move horizontally, and that will induce lateral forces in the building. But there are important differences. So a larger magnitude earthquake means that a longer section of the fault has ruptured. That means that there's probably more energy released and the duration of the ground shaking is longer. So the building will experience a larger number of load reversals during a larger earthquake. Another thing that happens is that the soil conditions can be different at different locations. And the softer the soil, this will amplify the earthquake motion. So a classic example here is the earthquake that hit Mexico City in 1985. The earthquake actually occurred. The epicenter of the earthquake was near the coast, over 300 kilometers from Mexico City. And the damage along the coast was very minor. But the very deep soft soil deposit under Mexico City actually amplified the ground motion, which caused a very high extent of damage in the engineered structures.
So do you have a similar kind of problem in the San Francisco area? I mean, I've heard stories, particularly thinking about the Loma Prieta earthquake, about soil liquefaction.
Yeah, that's right, Joe. The Loma Prieta earthquake occurred quite a ways south, a couple hundred kilometers south of San Francisco. But there was quite a bit of damage right around the bay. So the Marina District in San Francisco, the elevated structure, the Embarcadero, had that type of damage because the soft soils amplified the ground motion.
You made a distinction a little bit ago between buildings that are built just on the basis of people's experience and buildings that are designed. What's the role of building codes? What role does building codes play in limiting the vulnerability of structures to earthquakes?
So the first thing a building code does is it defines the forces that the buildings have to be designed to resist. So a building in the U.S. would be designed both for gravity loads and also lateral loads. In addition, the building codes define different types of structural systems that are permitted. And in regions that have the highest seismic risk, the building codes are much more stringent on the types of systems they'll allow. So here in Austin, where the earthquake risk is extremely low, they'll let us design unreinforced masonry buildings, for example, because under gravity loads, that's fine. But in many portions of the U.S., that type of system would not be permitted because the risk, due to the risk of earthquake, they don't want that building to collapse. And I think if you look at how building codes have changed in this country over the last 40 to 50 years, it's primarily been in the, or a key aspect has been in the definition of these structural systems that are permitted and in the level of details that have to go into the structural systems. What you're really concerned about in an earthquake is that the building is pushed in, it's pushed laterally in one direction and then it's pushed back in the other direction. So you have to be able to sustain large deformations and while still being able to carry the gravity loads. And that's the types of details that they have in the building codes.
And every time a major earthquake hits, engineers, scientists go to the scene, look at the damage, try to learn more about the impact of the earthquake on structures. What kind of things are learned on these visits?
Well, the most important thing is just to see how the buildings and the structural systems that we're using perform under real conditions. We can do tests in the laboratory, but we have to idealize. We can't test a whole structure. We can't test the foundation conditions. And so the earthquake gives us the real laboratory experience. I mean, you know, it's the full system, and we're able to see the weaknesses in these systems.
Have you made trips like that?
Yeah, I have, actually. I visited Chile after their earthquake in 1985. I also was able to visit the Northridge area right outside Los Angeles in 1994, and I went to Turkey after the earthquakes in 1999.
Did you learn things on those trips that you could not have learned by any other means?
Yeah, absolutely. With the Chile earthquake was very interesting because the type of construction in Chile was different than what we have in the U.S. They relied on structural walls very much more than we do. And at the time, the engineers in the U.S. were complaining. They thought that the building codes here were overly constraining them. And so based on going down and seeing how well the buildings performed in Chile, we were able to do some subsequent research and allow the building code provisions for walls to be relaxed. The Northridge earthquake in the U.S. was really important because it showed us that some of our modern construction practices weren't working as well as we thought. So there were some systems that had done really well in the laboratory, but when they were implemented in the field, they did not work as well. And so in that case, again, our design provisions really, really changed significantly after the earthquake.
So when you learn something like that, do we go back as a profession, as a society, and retrofit and fix buildings, or does it only affect what we do going forward?
That's a really good question. In most cases, it only affects how we move forward. So the building codes, as they're written today, influence the design of new construction. And so as we learn things, these provisions keep getting more stringent. If you're changing the use of an existing building, there's a limit in the building code. I don't remember what it is. But if you change the use by so much, then you're required to bring it up to current standards. But in most cases, you don't have to actually strengthen or retrofit existing buildings.
How effective is retrofitting altogether, both economically and, I mean, can you retrofit things to be as good as something that was built by a new design in the first place?
Yes, you can. I mean, the economic feasibility of it is going to depend on the individual building. There's no question about it. But there are countless examples of structures that have been retrofit around the U.S. We'll take California, for example. After the Northridge earthquake, the bridges, the interstate bridges and the state highway bridges, suffered quite a bit of damage. Now, the engineers knew those structures were vulnerable, but they couldn't get the money invested to make the upgrades. Because the bridges are so important to the transportation system of the state, after the earthquake, they were able to go in and upgrade the most vulnerable bridges across the whole state. So the bents or the bridges that are supported on single columns, the bridges that have really short seats, those were the ones that were the highest risk, and they've been retrofit. So the engineering community believes that those bridges will behave as well as new bridges. There are buildings and dorms on the campuses of Stanford and Berkeley that have been upgraded to improve their seismic response. And I think people will agree that they will achieve a level of the same as new construction.
It is interesting, I think, particularly if you walk around the San Francisco Bay Area, that you can see some of the retrofits. And they've not always been all that successful from an architectural standpoint, although from a security standpoint, they're very comforting.
Yeah, you're right. You see a lot of braces covering windows when you walk around, right?
So can you tell us a little bit about how building codes are put together and how they're modified? That is, probability plays a role, as you describe it. The experience with prior earthquakes and the kinds of forces and responses are important. Who's involved and how does it work?
Okay, there are a variety of different groups involved. The most people who write building codes will serve on volunteer committees through different professional organizations. So the American Society of Civil Engineers has a committee that writes the code that determines the forces for which buildings need to be designed. The American Concrete Institute has a committee that develops the detailing provisions for how concrete buildings are designed. The American Institute of Steel Construction governs steel construction. So it's distributed out based on kind of provisions that all buildings have to meet, and then specific details for different types of buildings. In terms of the risk, the maps for or the probability of the design earthquake, what kind of risk that corresponds to, the U.S. Geological Survey actually is responsible for developing maps that for across the country. And the current maps correspond to ground motions that have a probability of being exceeded, 2% probability of exceedance in 50 years. That corresponds to an earthquake that's about 2,500 years, a return period. Now, we don't actually use that for design. They develop that as kind of a uniform risk as the basis. And then the members of the Building Code Committee modify this so that there are different levels of risk across the U.S. In the regions of coastal California, where the earthquakes are more likely to occur, the design earthquake is maybe corresponds to a 100-year event. But in the Midwest, where there have been very large earthquakes in the past, but they're much less frequent, the design earthquake corresponds to maybe a 500-year event.
I guess that's comforting if you think about what life is like in California. I mean, I think it's much there are people, lots of people around who remember California earthquakes, and I think no one left that remembers New Madrid.
That's right. Yes. Right. Yeah, we're approaching the 200th anniversary of the New Madrid earthquakes, so you're right.
You think that the building codes in the U.S. are up to date? Are you satisfied with them based on the current knowledge about earthquake threats?
Okay, I'm going to waffle a little on this answer. I think that yes, they're definitely up to date. The building codes are updated frequently. As I mentioned, there are it's broken up into different components, but these components are updated every 3 to 6 years. So if you talk to the practicing structural engineers, they feel that maybe these are updated even too frequently. Because just as they become experienced with one code, a new set of provisions is published. But having said that, the goal of the current codes is to protect the life of the building occupants. They want to prevent the building from collapsing. And not all building owners understand that, or the general public doesn't necessarily understand it. A lot of people think that if you're building to the code, that your building will not be damaged in the earthquake. And that is not true. So one of the things that's happening in the U.S. right now is they're looking at trying to explicitly state the performance expectations so that if you're the owner of a manufacturing facility and the cost of the building is actually small compared with the cost of what you produce, you might want to design for higher standards. These are called it's called performance-based design. You might want to design your structure so that it could be occupied immediately after the earthquake or operational right after the earthquake. So if you're looking for that level of behavior, we have not yet reached it in the U.S. Our building codes don't provide that. I think it's going to be in the next 5 to 10 years those types of codes will be developed. So just to summarize, right now our building codes are really trying to make sure that buildings don't collapse and they don't kill people.
So it's really focused on life safety matters rather than protecting the infrastructure itself.
That's correct. Okay. Right.
So are other countries more advanced than we are in that respect?
You know, I think this idea of the performance-based design and looking at both economic and recovery costs, that's being phased in other countries too. In Japan might be a little ahead of us, but no one has really implemented this type of code yet.
It's interesting when we bring this up because performance-based design and performance-based management is a trend across the infrastructure field. Like it's not just in building codes and earthquake design, but it's in overall performance of the infrastructure. I think there's a lot more focus on it, and it's an area where we're learning across the board fairly rapidly.
I think you're right. I think that when codes are first developed, they're very prescriptive. They tell you have to do this, you have to do that. And then you realize that people actually want to achieve different performance categories, and it's very difficult to do within the prescriptive codes. And so that's the stage where we are now in the earthquake engineering.
If we go in the direction of performance codes, does that give us more flexibility in terms of introducing new materials?
Possibly. I'm a little hesitant there because the costs of concrete and steel, our traditional building materials, are relatively low. And when you start comparing that with some of the newer materials like the carbon fiber, the unit cost is so high that it probably won't have as large an impact in the engineering field or in infrastructure. But you're right. And by setting performance targets, then if you develop, let's say, a new system that still relies on steel and concrete, but you're putting it together in a different way, you now have specific performance targets, and it should be easier to introduce that new type of system into the codes, right?
How safe are structures in earthquake-prone U.S. cities today? Are there any locales that you see particularly as being at risk?
You know, that's it's a difficult question in that the codes are not enforced uniformly across the U.S. Along the West Coast, because as Joe mentioned, people remember the last earthquake and the threat is there. They've been much more proactive in making sure that the codes that they adopt are up to date, and that they're proactive in using best design procedures. In other parts of the U.S., such as the Midwest, the last damaging earthquake happened almost 200 years ago. They don't expect the return period for earthquakes in that area is 500 years. People don't think it's going to happen during their lifetime or during the life of the building. And so for other economic reasons, they might decide that they don't want to use the most modern codes because it's going to increase the cost of the building. And so they might not be able to attract industry to that location. If the cost is too high, they might decide to go somewhere else where the seismic risk is less.
Interesting. So they're really, you're dealing with trade-offs there as well.
That's correct. Yeah. Right. And so the way that the codes are written in the U.S., we actually have one code. But not even the states, the municipalities have to adopt the codes. And so if they're feeling that, you know, they can't compete economically, they might not adopt the most recent code. And that's where some of the difficulties come in.
It seems to me that there's the possibility, at least, of an insidious problem in that those who occupy the buildings and even those who own the buildings may not really fully understand what the nature of the risks and the trade-offs are.
I think you're right, and I think that's where along the West Coast, for example, where the risks are so high, I think that's where they've been really good at having outreach, trying to let people know how important it is. They also have had things like mandatory retrofit programs, where the most vulnerable buildings, the owners are given a period of time whereby they either have to fix them, you know, retrofit them, or tear them down. Now that isn't true. As you start getting into regions where earthquakes are less likely to occur, that type of public awareness isn't there, and it's a, you know, the politicians, even the engineers, they're looking on a shorter term basis of trying to make sure that looking at the economics of the region, and the long term risk of the earthquake doesn't always factor in.
Yeah, and I guess one of the stories that I've heard is that there are cases where household insurance in a condominium is great for a modest problem, but if there's a big structural damage due to an earthquake, they have no coverage on it. And people were left hanging because they didn't know what the risk was.
That's right, right.
So are you still chasing earthquakes, or have you given that up?
It's still near and dear to my heart. Right now, I've temporarily given it up while I'm department chair.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, I hope there's no good reason to chase them, but if there is, that you have another opportunity to learn. Sharon, this has been a tremendously good conversation for us. We really appreciate your being with us, and we thank you very much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.